Peter B. Collins with news and commentary here on Thursday, March 15th, 2012.
Give us 20 minutes and we'll give you the world. We bring good things to life.
Many people who listen to this podcast also listen to National Public Radio, and you might find it infuriating, particularly on issues, like climate change, where NPR insists on bringing in a debunker, someone to challenge the settled science, so that there is the appearance of balance, so that, quote-unquote, both sides get coverage. Well, National Public Radio has issued new editorial guidelines rejecting this kind of false balance, what's known as he said, she said journalism. NPR's new code of ethics says that if the balance of evidence in a matter of controversy weighs heavily on one side, we acknowledge it in our reports. Hallelujah! I have to say that I only use NPR a little because I am so frustrated by the way their reporters are always looking over the proverbial shoulder at a right-winger who wants to cut off federal funding for NPR. And for this to occur in the heated partisan climate of this election year, I think is remarkable. So, NPR, right on, keep at it. Jeffrey D. Sachs is a professor at Columbia University. He was a guest on our program last fall. You can find the podcast in the October archives from 2011 at peterbcollins.com. And I was so impressed with him. His title, Director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University. And he published a book called The Price of Civilization. Today I learned that he has broken protocol and put himself forward as a candidate for president of the World Bank. There's an opening there. Robert Zeller has resigned. And the candidate preferred by President Obama is Lawrence Summers. Larry Summers, the bankster who was brought in with the Obama team early and who many progressives feel has been a real negative influence on Obama, on the failure to nationalize banks like Citibank when they were underwater and we bailed them out, and for the general pro-business, pro-Wall Street approach of trying to resuscitate the economy. And I think this is great. I hope that there is a true debate, and I'd love to see Professor Sachs get the job. And I pulled out his book and opened it to one of the pages that I had marked when I spoke to him last October. And he made a number of proposals that are very progressive for ways of improving the American economy and political system. And here's a paragraph that I just happened to find flipping through the book. Quote, "When Obama became president, many of us hoped he would chase the moneylenders out of the Capitol. The financial crisis had exposed the tawdry side of Wall Street and politics and the intertwined tentacles connecting the two. Yet before the first stock market bell of his presidency had rung, Obama had installed a pro-banking team at the White House led by Larry Summers. For the first 2 years of his administration, he sided mostly with the bankers, providing bailouts but asking for and getting too little in return regarding restraints on salaries, bonuses, and other abusive behaviors of the past. The bankers, not surprisingly, continued to feign surprise and hurt when anybody suggested their complicity in the crisis or the need to restrain their gargantuan pay. Whether Obama will ever take on Wall Street and the other corporate interest groups remains an open question, though hopes have grown somewhat dim." Now, in pure political terms, it seems that that's enough to sink the candidacy of Jeffrey Sachs as president of the World Bank. But it's exactly what we need. And he has a deep history of helping economies recover in various parts of the world without the kind of disaster capitalism and Chicago School of Economics brutality described by Naomi Klein in her landmark book. Other news in Washington, the Republicans are gearing up for another bruising fight. As if the battle against women over contraception that recently surfaced is not enough. And the Democrats are using a certain piece of legislation that's about to expire as a political weapon. I will freely acknowledge that. They are backing the Republicans into a corner. The issue is the Violence Against Women Act, which was originally passed in 1994 and is up for extension. Harry Reid, the Democratic leader in the Senate, has said he'll push for a vote by the end of March. And can Republicans actually say that they're against the Violence Against Women Act? Well, some can, because the legislation will continue existing programs, but it also expands efforts to reach Indian tribes, to provide extra coverage for battered illegal immigrants, including temporary visas, and would include same-sex couples in programs for domestic violence. Now, we just got through a soap opera here in San Francisco where our newly elected sheriff, before he even took office, was charged with domestic violence against his wife. They had a fight on New Year's Eve, and he grabbed her arm. That's what's known publicly. He took a plea deal. But the issues raised here were front and center. His wife is an immigrant from Venezuela. Part of their struggle was that she wanted to go home, and he was afraid he would take the she would take their son and not come back. And given that there was an incident, and his Venezuelan wife was in a very weak position because her husband might have her deported if she didn't cooperate, we can see here in San Francisco the need for this legislation. Roy Blunt of Missouri, the guy who tried to pass the law that would allow any employer to stop paying for health insurance coverage of contraception if the employer claimed a religious belief. Roy Blunt says, well, obviously you want to be for the title, the Violence Against Women Act. If Republicans can't be for it, we need to have a very convincing alternative. Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski lectured her colleagues saying, we're on the wrong side of a losing battle. So I find this very interesting because 1992 was the year of the woman, and our junior senator from California, Barbara Boxer, led a charge to bring more women into Congress. And there's much more to fight about right now. And while I do acknowledge that this is a partisan issue that's being used in a partisan way, it's about time that Democrats stood up, took on the Republicans, and beat them. So we'll see how this turns out, but it is encouraging. GOP presidential candidate Rick Santorum went to San Juan, Puerto Rico, looking for votes to try to pick up some delegates to advance his cause for the Republican presidential nomination. And while he was there, he turned off a lot of Puerto Ricans by responding to a question about statehood, by essentially dodging it and saying you should have the right to self-determination. But then he said if you join the union, you have to, because of the Constitution, adopt English as the only official language of Puerto Rico. Now, the only problem is it's not true. The Constitution does not specify that English is the official language of the United States. That is a figment of Rick Santorum's imagination, and it probably will not win him any votes from Puerto Rico. Also, and I connect these two without attempting to blame Rick Santorum for this, but at the NCAA tournament game, members of the Southern Mississippi University Band chanted against Kansas State University. And one of Kansas State's star players is a Puerto Rican, and his name is Angel Rodriguez. And at one point, Rodriguez got fouled, stepped up to the foul line, and Southern Miss band members began chanting. And it sounded like this.
As you see Mills trying to come over and draw the charge, Rodriguez has already let the ball go, and he's a freshman, but he's about as cool as they come, right?
So the Mississippi Marching Band is there repeatedly chanting, "Where's your green card?" Last time I checked, citizens of Puerto Rico are citizens of the United States. He doesn't require a green card. Which is worse, the racism or the ignorance? Rocky Anderson, who got a lot of attention because as the mayor of Salt Lake City, he went public back around 2006 or 2007, calling for the impeachment of George W. Bush and Richard Cheney. Rocky Anderson has announced that he is a candidate for president this year, and many of us have been looking for an alternative to Obama, if only as the vehicle for a protest vote. If you want to find out more, go to rockyforamerica.com, and I've asked for an interview with the former mayor, so we'll try to get him on the program in the near future. I last spoke to him when he started an organization called High Road for Human Rights. And he is a great man who has a lot to offer, and it'll be very interesting to see. It does seem that he is angling to pick up the endorsement of this murky centrist group called America Elects. They've raised some $20 or more million from unnamed sources and are shopping for a candidate who they will propose and then allow people to embrace or endorse via an online process that hasn't been detailed. I don't know how that's going to turn out, but I welcome the voice of Rocky Anderson to this year's political debate. Federal prosecutors who handled the prosecution of Alaska Senator Ted Stevens were slammed by an investigator appointed by the court in a 500-page report released today. Quote, "The investigation and prosecution of Senator Ted Stevens were permeated by the systematic concealment of significant exculpatory evidence, which would have independently corroborated Stevens' defense and his testimony, and seriously damaged the testimony and credibility of the government's key witness." Now, this is pretty remarkable for the Justice Department, and I realize a court appointed this independent investigator, but to reach these findings on a case that was bungled so badly by the U.S. Department of Justice is refreshing. Now, I would like to read the same quote again. And if you have followed my efforts related to the Don Siegelman persecution prosecution in the state of Alabama, he's the former Democratic governor, railroaded into prison by Karl Rove's cronies, and I believe he deserves the same treatment. Quote, "The investigation and prosecution of Don Siegelman were permeated by the systematic concealment of significant exculpatory evidence." Yeah, like the judge who should have recused himself, the prosecutors who were in cahoots with Karl Rove and the Republican higher-ups, the phony evidence that was presented, the witness who was coached 64 times in order to get it right. Well, that's what we need in the Siegelman case. Can the Justice Department do the right thing more than once? We will see. My friend David Earnhardt, filmmaker from Nashville, sent me a message on Facebook today, and I want to share a part of this because David's a filmmaker who's very committed to election integrity in this country. And he covered a hearing at the state legislature in Nashville yesterday where former Marine Tim Thompson testified. And at the end of this hearing, following his testimony, the committee approved the repeal of Tennessee's voter ID law by a vote of 5-3. And we've seen voter ID laws challenged in Texas and in other locations around the country. This is becoming a very clear issue of attempted voter suppression by Republicans. Let's listen to the final few comments here from former Marine Tim Thompson talking and delivering testimony to this committee in the legislature in Tennessee.
So for one day, for 5 minutes, when you vote, forget the party that you belong to. And remember, we're all Americans. This law is a slap in the face to all the soldiers that fought and died for this country. It has no place in America. And finally, I'm standing in my bedroom this morning looking at the flag raising on Iwo Jima and asked myself what those Marines thought as they raised that flag. Did they do it just for some of the Americans or half of the Americans? No, they did not. They did it for all Americans. So for their sacrifice and all the Marines and soldiers that have paid the ultimate price for this thing we call freedom, you need to vote to appeal this law. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much.
That's former Marine Tim Thompson testifying in Nashville yesterday. And as we mentioned, the committee voted to overturn the voter ID law in Tennessee. We'll see and follow that. And my thanks to David Earnhardt for sending it along. People who use Apple products like me, we have a chance to express ourselves. Apple is sitting on nearly $100 billion in cash. One of the most profitable companies in the world today. And if anybody can set an example of returning manufacturing to the United States, or at minimum, making sure that its manufacturing chain in China adheres to fundamental human and labor rights, this is the company that can do it. And I want to credit the people at change.org. Wherever you are, log on to change.org and take a look, because on Friday, there will be protests at Apple stores in Washington, D.C., in New York City, and here in San Francisco. In San Francisco, it starts at 8 a.m. at the Apple store at 1 Stockton Street in downtown area. And a guy named Mark Shields started this effort back in February. He's delivered 250,000 petition signatures to 6 Apple stores around the world. And I think that this is a movement that deserves your support, that has some interesting momentum right now, and I'd like to see it go forward. So if you're so inclined, I hope you will participate. Recently, I raised the question about why the city of Oakland has failed to launch investigations into police wrongdoing from the protests that occurred last October and November around the Occupy movement. And in particular, the severe injuries to Scott Olson, who served in Iraq and Afghanistan, and who was hit on the head, we thought, by a tear gas canister. But now a careful review of video footage shows that he was targeted by a cop with a beanbag gun, and that this shot came from less than 30 feet away and appeared to be aimed intentionally at his head. Now, I am momentarily pleased that we're learning about this and that there is some movement in the investigation. It was a police riot, and people deserve to be disciplined. And from the San Francisco Chronicle today, buried in this story that was buried pretty deep in the paper, is a tidbit I was not aware of. Quote, probes of the Occupy protests are being conducted by the department's major crime section, as well as a private contractor, the Fraser Group, which is helping determine if any city employees should be fired or disciplined. Now, wait a minute. The police department is investigating itself with the help of a private contractor, the Fraser Group, that I've never heard of before? Whatever happened to a public inquiry, a citizens' commission, a police commission? I'm going to follow up on this, but I'm very concerned that Oakland has a contractor helping the cops investigate themselves. That is not a recipe for justice. It's not credible. It's not transparent. And it is so Oakland. At America's airports, if you're over 75, you can keep your shoes on. You can skip the pat down. And you can wear a light jacket through the metal detector. Now, I don't know who's going to check your age. I don't know if they're going to define a light jacket or exactly how. But this is just another adjustment in the security theater at America's airports. And while any relaxation of these ridiculous procedures is welcome, I don't really get why this is limited to people over 75, and that this just introduces more variability into the process. Now, to some extent, varying the process is probably a better way of catching bad guys. Because if they can't predict exactly who's going to be stopped or why, well, it makes it harder for them to game the system. But fundamentally, this is just so ridiculous. It's a waste of time, a waste of money. And I believe that the main intention is to scare you shitless before you get on a plane. And hope that the fear that is imposed on you at the airport will trickle down to the rest of your life as well. We've heard about all that partisan gridlock in Washington. Well, the Senate finally broke through and produced a transportation bill, a two-year bill, passing on a vote of 74 to 22. That's pretty remarkable in today's Senate. It's worth $109 billion, and this was due to expire at the end of March, and money from the gas tax fund would have stopped flowing. Now I think it goes to the House, where we'll see exactly what the nuts over there decide to do. And a couple of more items for you today. The Center for Constitutional Rights, on behalf of a Ugandan gay rights group, has filed suit against an American evangelist, Scott Lively, in federal court in Massachusetts because of his role in encouraging the nation of Uganda to adopt the death penalty for people simply because they are homosexuals. This was a bill considered by the legislature in 2009. It was ultimately withdrawn after outcry from people in Europe and the United States. But a revised bill was reintroduced last month, replacing the death penalty with life imprisonment as a maximum sentence. Now, this man's name is Lively, Scott Lively. And he has traveled to Uganda, Latvia, and Moldova, warning Christian clergy to defend their countries against the onslaught of gay rights advocates based in the West. And he once told the Associated Press that he doesn't oppose the criminalization of gays. However, he thinks that imprisonment and the death penalty are too harsh. So Pamela Spees, a lawyer for the Ugandan group, is at the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York. And she said the lawsuit brings the fight to those in the United States who have fomented the anti-gay legislation in Uganda. And she says the lawsuit is targeted at Lively's actions, not his religious speech or beliefs. And finally today, the International Criminal Court, which the United States does not support, we're not signatory to the treaty that created it, that criminal court has found Congolese warlord Thomas Lubanga guilty of using children as soldiers. It's the first verdict in the panel's 10-year history, and he could face life imprisonment. In the pipeline behind him, Joseph Kony, who recently became a YouTube sensation here in the United States, as people learned about his Lord's Resistance Army and his brutal history, despite some of the inaccuracies in that video. Also, President Omar Hassan Ahmed Bashir of Sudan was the first sitting head of state to be indicted for crimes against humanity. Can we make room for Bush and Cheney? In the pipeline? Someday soon? I'd like to see that. Thanks for joining me for today's news and comment. Catch my latest podcast about the Rush Limbaugh boycott at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.